Bush Dhaka is good for your health.
It's Decolonize Your Diet with Delani and Caillou Bales.
So eat 'em, Bush Dhaka. Eat 'em every day.
Decolonize Your Diet, a show that will change the way you think about hunting, gathering, and Bush Dhaka in general.
Bush Dhaka is good for your health.
And here's your hosts, Delani and Caillou Bales.
Honey.
Introducing our new series, Decolonize Your Diet, a 10-part series of interviews with those on the front line of health revolution in Australia. Our guest, John Newton, asks if Australia has the oldest, most nutritious food on earth, why aren't we eating them? Bill Gemmage explains in his book how the Australian landscape resembled a gentleman's estate, and Uncle Bruce Pascoe also shares his perspective of what our land looked like at the time of colonisation and asks, was this agriculture or accident? After 200 years, we have the information needed to thrive again as our first people did in this land for tens of thousands of years.
Bush Dhaka is good for your health.
It's Decolonise Your Diet.
Honey.
So that the full impact of what we mean by colonisation is understood in its context, let us begin with a short lesson on colonialism, words by Murray Elder, Anilila Watson. This is necessary because colonisation is seen in Western minds as something in the past that should stay there and be forgotten about. While the impact of the process on the colonised is recognised, there is a reluctance on the part of the colonisers to recognise how they too have lost something of their humanity. So many in this land see the difference between Murrays and those boat people who began coming here over 200 years ago as being one of race, rather than the difference between coloniser and the colonised. That difference and the historical legacy of colonisation is at the root of much of the conflict throughout the world today. Resolving it can contribute insights into the solution of other conflicts, globally and locally.
Welcome everyone, and to our guest John Newton, world-renowned food journalist and author of well-known book, The Oldest Foods on Earth. He joins us today for another segment of Decolonize Your Diet. Welcome.
Caillou, good morning.
This is a book about Australian food, not the foods that European Australians cooked from ingredients they brought with them, but the flora and fauna that nourished the Aboriginal peoples for over 50,000 years. It is because European Australians have hardly touched these foods for over 200 years that John wrote the book. What inspired you to write about Bush Dhaka, John?
Well, I was a restaurant critic years ago at the Sydney Morning Herald, and I ate a dish of kangaroo, beautiful dish, the recipe for which is in the book, at a restaurant called Oasis Sea Rice, cooked by a bloke called Philip Searle. And it struck me at the time that I had never eaten. Probably the only Australian native food I'd eaten was a macadamia nut, and I probably thought it was Hawaiian at the time. So I thought, well, why is this so? Why haven't we eaten a kangaroo? At the time also, I wasn't aware of how much food there was. So I began to sort of poke around, as you do, and meet people. And I met some of the cooks who were doing the food in those days. One of the real pioneers is a French bloke called Jean-Paul Brunetto. He was the first to actually do this properly, a European bloke to do it properly, because he decided he wanted to cook Australian food. Then there were others like Raymond and Janice Kirsch and Mark Olive, Black Olive down in Melbourne, Andrew Felke, and much later on Clayton Donovan. So what I wanted to find out after all this was, why have we ignored these foods for so long? It seemed to me not just stupid from a point of view of good food, but disrespectful to the country and the people.
About time too.
Well, it's a bit late, but still, better late than never, isn't it?
No, that's a perfect timing. I think we're closing the gap, that's all. You know, we've got such an epidemic there with all the statistics show that the gap's widening. This Bush Dhaka to be raised and researched in depth like it is by Bill Gemmage, by yourself and Uncle Bruce Pascoe, I think it's about time, that's all.
I think there's a lot of things happening. I know the gap's widening and I know there are terrible things going on and I know kids are being taken away, but the attitudes, I look at film, I look at television, I look at these things, I look at the shows like Black Comedy, films like Sapphire, and they are terrific representations of and celebrations of the Australia of the Indigenous people, and I think we white fellas are getting more aware of that. I think the fact that we're starting to cook the foods is another indication of that. I think it's a good thing.
I totally agree, even with the creation of NITV. We've got a lot more mainstream followers than we could ever imagine. What some of the programming, they've got their regulars that they watch all the time. So I think you're right there.
It's more than about food, because food is more. Food is about culture. As I said before, Bruce Pascoe says, you've said sorry, now you should say thank you. Thank you for delivering this wonderful land to us in the condition in which it was delivered. And then, of course, we bugger it up.
Yeah, it's a good point, that one. It gives you goosebumps. The Oldest Food on Earth is a passionate and optimistic consideration of food, culture and ecology. With everyone obsessed with superfoods these days, why do you think it is that more Australians don't eat Indigenous food?
That is the question. That is the central question. And that's what I found out from writing this book, Caillou. The real problem is that we ignore these foods for so long, it's going to take us a long time to catch up. I mean, if you take the tomato, which was introduced to Europe from America, and it took, you know, nearly 100 years for people to start eating it, we now have to catch up. We have to work out on how to eat these foods. We have to incorporate them into a European diet, because we're not eating them the way they were eaten by the people before 1788. And we have to work out which ones that we will cultivate, which ones we will use. And we have to work out ways to work with the people so we can work with them to get the foods out and onto plate and into people's homes. But it's going to take a while, because it's a very slow, slow process. It's better. You now can get things like rue and Tasmanian pepper. You can get lemon myrtle, finger limes. I've got finger limes in my local supermarket, but it's still hard to get a lot of these terrific ingredients onto our plates in the home.
And food is, like you said, it is culture. It's more than nourishment. Food shapes our culture. Food binds us together, forces us apart. In the same way, accepting the food of this land will, you believe, in your words, will contribute towards what you call the culinary reconciliation. Since writing that book, what changes have you seen?
What changes have I seen? Unfortunately, very few, but I see what I call green shoots, changes of attitude. When I first started looking at people who are using this stuff in restaurants, and it is mainly in restaurants still, the chefs who were using it were being ignored by the critics. They looked down on the food and said, this is tourist food. That really made me very angry. These foods that have kept the people of this country alive and healthy for over 50,000 years. I think our attitudes changed. And it was funnily in 2010, a chef came from Denmark, a bloke called René Redzepi, who I write about in the book. He did a speech at the Opera House, and he said to all these people, all these young chefs who didn't have this kind of attitude, he said to them, why aren't you using this stuff? It's terrific. And so from that moment on, they went out and started finding out about how to incorporate these foods into their menus. That was the beginning, I think, of a change in attitude towards native produce, bush tucker.
Definitely have to catch up with René and thank him for influencing and making it cool, I suppose, amongst other young cooks in Australia and chefs.
It was a good thing, but I mean, it was the time was right. 2010 was a time where our European races started to disappear, and I hope they'll disappear even more over the years, although I know there's a lot of racism still about. And that's the other thing about food, you know. That's one of the reasons I learned from doing my research and talking to people why the food was ignored, is because there was racist attitudes. It was seen as blackfella food.
There's a bit of a talk about the response that restaurateurs used to get.
Right. The one from Raymond Kirsch, which was really pretty terrible. But, you know, it just reminds you how important food is, how central to culture food is.
Like you say, it can bring us together or tear us apart, you know?
That's right. Yeah.
It's torn us apart, so it's time we use it, like you say, bring us back together. We know that to label Aboriginal people or blackfellas as hunters and gatherers is inadequate to describe the complex and time-honoured ways in which they manage the entire country. Do you know anywhere this is still happening? Are there many others involved with this type of research or working to make the necessary changes after reading your work?
There's a lot of research been going on into these foods and, you know, research into what the extraordinary levels of nutrients they have in them. I mean, you know, the Kakadu plum, or gubbins as it's called over in the West, is one of them. Do I know of anywhere where people are still living the life that was lived before 1788? The closest that I have come to looking at that, and I haven't done a lot of travelling around, but I found a book called Welcome to My Country, written by a woman called Laklak Budawanga and her family. She's from northeast Arnhem Land, and that is a beautiful book, and it gives the most incredible outline of the life they live in that part of Australia, and the way that they gather food, the seasons they use, the things they eat, and the way they cook it. So I would say there, at least as far as I know, those people are living very close to the pre-1788 way of food gathering, looking after the land that was practiced in before 1788, before we arrived here with our crops and our livestock. Lousy agriculture.
Thank you very much for sharing that. It's an honour, I suppose, and it's important to know that it's still alive and well, our old ways. You know, they're very masterful and genius. Obviously I'm saddened, you know, with all of the changes that have been made to landscape and our food and diet, well-being, humans as a whole, not just, you know, our people here in Australia. I think the upside of that is hearing about this, you know, mob still living the old way. Like, is it Aniluklak, did you say?
Laklak Budawanga.
Laklak Budawanga, you know, it's really, for a black fella living in the city, growing up all her life in places like Redfern, I think nothing makes me more happy inside than to hear and just to know that these old fellows are still keep this knowledge alive on the ground.
And you know the extraordinary thing, Caillou, that for all the years, we Europeans, didn't just trample over the landscape. We kind of stopped you hunting and farming the way you were because we said it was primitive. For all that, there is so much knowledge still kept in the country and on country. There's so much knowledge still there and it's waking up.
Some people say our culture is dying or we've had our culture stolen. I think it's still alive and well. We just need to wake her up, you know.
Of course it's still alive and well. And, of course, people like Bruce Pascoe you'll be speaking to and his Gurundji Minji mob who are reworking out ways in which we can start using crops like Murrunung again and the way they can start baking, you know. He will tell you how important baking is and using kangaroo grass to bake bread with.
There's one thing that I really want to see through programs like this, through books like yours and the other books on the same topic or, you know, that are closely related, is just for young fellas to pick up this awareness and actually get passionate, you know, about the nutrient qualities. We're all talking about spirulina, olive leaf, chia seeds. Get them to start replacing that with, you know, knowledge of their bush tucker and how much vitamin C is in the Kakadu plum, just for starters.
And that struck me during the course of... I did a lot of touring around the country selling this book last year. And what struck me is that Aboriginal Australians are... And I might get into trouble for saying this. I reckon they're the only people who are doing truly original art and music in the country. We Europeans, we have a culture that's all art and music, which has come from somewhere else. So that's not so with Aboriginal Australians. They've got their own art and culture. It is unique and it is their own.
Very original.
And I think it's going to be the same with cooking. Once young blackfella kids come into the kitchen and start cooking using these ingredients, they will create the unique dishes because they have the creativity and they have the first-hand knowledge of the stuff.
Yeah, there's a young chef on Stradbroke Island, Kieran. Yeah, he's got a Facebook page and I happened to flick through it, obviously, even before this came up, but I revisited it just to make sure that I was, you know, just, I don't know, a bit of inspiration because I'm doing this series now. And he's got everything up there with their traditional names as well, like all of the local ingredients that he's used from the island. He's got totally different mixtures, you know, like on his plate compared to other people. So what you're saying is happening.
That's true, and it is happening, and I think it's going to get more. I was at a TAFE down in Victoria where they've got a big grant to get young Indigenous kids to come in and learn how to cook. And once they do that and once they start to look at the stuff that they've got available to cook with, that's when it'll start to really, I think it'll start to really take off.
And when we've got more suppliers too, you know, so that young chefs have got those fresh supplies.
There's a group called ANFL, Australian Native Food Industry Limited, which is the peak body, and it's the board. There hasn't been for a while, a bit embarrassing. There's now two Indigenous people on the board, and there's a terrific woman called Amanda Garner who is working very hard to get some sort of intellectual property rights for the food so that, I mean, for example, Amanda told me just a while ago that somebody has made an application, not an Indigenous group, but a European group, to buy the name Kakadu Plum and to take it away. Now, we have to work very hard on working out a system, and it might be something like a fair trade system. It might be something like some sort of support so the ownership of these products, these plants and this produce is kept within the groups who have the rights to own it. There's a guy called Richard Gunner, a butcher, who's now working with the Latakia people up in Darwin on harvesting magpie geese. But he's formed a company and he's become a minor shareholder in the company. But the major shareholders are all Latakia people.
Wow.
So they own that business.
Very important.
That's the way it's got to be done.
Very important that it's done ethically. And that leads us into the next question. There are complex issues raised by taking and using the cultural capital of Aboriginal peoples. In the chapter Cultural Conundrums, you acknowledge the necessity for valuing Indigenous knowledge and returning value to the communities. You say, it seems to me reasonable that European Australians acknowledge Aboriginal ownership of these foods as they do of all the land and work with them to ensure that, at very least, some of the proceeds of sales of the plants goes back to the community. Difficult to enact. And ownership is not the only question. So how is this sort of stuff being addressed?
Well, that's one of the things that Anfal and Amanda are trying to work on, to try and work out a system. You know the fair trade system that works for coffee?
Yes.
If you could work out a fair trade system that works for Indigenous produce, Australian native produce, so the people who grow it and the people who have the traditional knowledge of it are included in the trade when these things are traded, it will require government assistance. That will require the government to understand the importance of food, and I'm afraid at the moment they just do not do that.
No. Maybe something that Supply Nation, because they have to have certifications.
Right.
Yeah, that, maybe something that the government could work with Supply Nation on, you know, just as some kind of tick of approval, hey?
Yeah. Well, they've got to understand that the importance of this money, you know. Kakadu plum, there's people all over the world wanting this product for all sorts of reasons. It's an extraordinary plant, but we've got to keep it. We've got to not let it get taken away. It's already happened once. The Mary Kay Cosmetic Company got an American patent for part of the plum, an extract of the plum. They couldn't get it in Australia, so they went to America and got it through America. So they stole that from the Australian, the Indigenous people they were working with on that product. So we've got to be very careful not to allow this to happen.
The integrity is very, very important, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But the same token, it's very difficult. I mean, if I plant a ribery tree, I got two ribery trees or two lily pillies in the backyard in my house in Glebe. You know, I mean, they're my trees. I use the fruit. It's an Australian product. What about the street trees? I mean, who owns the street trees? It's a difficult problem, and they've got to work out the edges. Obviously, the Kakadu plum is something that's owned by the people who around whom it grows, and they're aware of that. There's a guy called Meridu Walbidi who works with a guy called Kim Courtney over in Broome, what they call savanna enrichment, cool burning and planting gubbins trees there. Well, he said, what we have to do, and he does it with Kim, we have to learn to walk together.
Mm.
And that's a very simple concept for politicians and business people to understand, but they don't seem to get it.
They've had the option for a long time too.
That's right.
We've had a lot of big-hearted leaders who've offered them, you know, to walk with us for a long time and start this healing process.
Yeah, but we take over. The white fellow says, no, you come with us. We'll do it our way.
I think it's all coming to a head now. People are starting to realise that what the tribes are obligated to maintain and hold on to and, you know, revitalise even for future generations to make relevant today, it makes a lot more sense than the lack of wisdom, the lack of culture that most of us accept as normal, you know?
Yeah.
So they're all starting to come home in a sense, you know?
Well, I think we're waking up. It's been a long time.
Yes. No, but I mean just coming home into that, back to being human again.
Yeah,
and that's when we'll have a proper chance. But this food, if we can sit down and, you know, if we can chow down together and yarn about how important it is, carry on these traditions and to keep these foods available for younger generations to reclaim our health, close the gaps. I think, you know, we're on the right track if we can walk together, eat together and
That's terrific.
Yeah, and start to preserve what's here because it belongs to all of us who call this place home today, you know?
That's right. It does.
Yeah.
But we have to respect the fact that you've got the knowledge and we should work with you to acquire that knowledge.
Yeah, it's a two-way street. I think we've got a lot more to offer than the average Joe realises and people are starting to realise.
Yeah.
And just lastly, with recipes from chefs such as Peter Gilmore, Maggie Beer, Renee Redzepi, the oldest foods on earth will convince you that this is one food revolution that really matters. What's next for you? What do you hope to see in the future?
Well, I hope to see a continued moving ahead with producers and, you know, walking together to make this food more available. There are people like Mike and Gail Cornby who have got the Reedy Station Nursery who go and plant in remote communities to build gardens. There's the project with Richard Gunner and the Larrakia people. All these people working together and walking together so we can develop this business and develop this produce into a business so it feeds back and gives some income back into the Indigenous people. That's what I'd like to see happen. And that's just going to be, I'm afraid, a slow process, can't you?
Yeah, it's
not
great.
Happen overnight.
No, but it's just great knowing that you're involved and you can really feel how passionate you are when you pronounce the words with proper knowledge. You've listened, you've heard, you've felt. It gives me hope.
Well, it's got to happen. And I think you said your father was very keen on that sort of exchange of knowledge between the two cultures. And they shouldn't be two cultures. There's one culture, Australia. I mean, we You have a much richer culture than we do. We have a fractured culture.
Yeah, we should be assimilating you into ours.
I mean, I'm a bit of Russian, a bit of German, a bit of Irish, and a bit of a God knows what.
Mm.
But you know where you came from. You know, I came from all over. I'm a mongrel.
No, but yeah, we all call this place home. You're right. You know, there should only be that one people.
Yeah,
and we don't want to be called like Pauline Hanson and do the One Nation thing. But she just hijacked a very, very good. It's more than a title. It's a way forward, you know, that One Nation. We want to be One Nation. It's a pity that somebody like Pauline Hanson had to hijack it. But anyway,
One Nation with diversity.
That's yes.
She forgets the diversity.
But anyway, I'm not going to go there with my Caillou spiel. This work that you do, John, it's very interesting and even more important. Where can people follow your work? Where can they find you?
Well, at the moment, I'm still doing a lot of promotion of this book. I haven't started another one yet, but I want to just send out a message to meet my publisher to do another one. I don't know what it'll be on the next time. The book is important. Bill Gammage is important. You know, if people haven't read The Biggest Estate on Earth, they should read that. Bruce Pascoe is important. You know, those three books, and of course, people like Henry Reynolds.
Mm.
They're very important things to read for what's called the new historiography of Australia, the new version of Australian history.
Historiography.
That's the word. That's the academic word, apparently.
It must be the word of the ages, too.
We've changed. People as clever as Charles Darwin said, the Aboriginal people are just wandering savages with nowhere to live. They didn't know. They didn't listen. They didn't talk. And especially if you read Bill Gammage and Bruce Pascoe, you'll realise that's absolute nonsense.
Mm. Yeah, no, it was far from that. If only they really knew, huh?
Well, if we'd listened.
Exactly.
If we'd asked the questions.
Imagine, though, the difference that it would have made, you know, if we'd have met on equal terms and a little bit more appreciation and acceptance and see a little bit further than, the nakedness.
Yeah, well, you know, anyway, no point in going back.
No,
it's
no.
The wonderful thing that Bill Gammage, I'd just like to, you know, say this before I go.
Yep.
Bill Gammage says at the end of his book, he says of us Europeans, we have a continent to learn.
Mm.
If we are to survive, let alone feel at home, we must begin to understand our country. If we succeed one day, we might become Australian.
Couldn't agree more.
You know, one way of achieving this, as you've said, we may sit down as brothers and sisters and share a meal.
Mm. Plant some trees together too, that's another thing
and
we need to start
some
doing.
Plant trees together.
Yep.
Yeah. We've got to sort of start maybe recognising the different seasons that were here, not the ones that we brought in with us, the four seasons that came here.
No.
I think there are seven seasons up in Arnhem Land.
Yes, there's a young fellow I just found out on the boat trip coming here today that's working on the seasons from North Stradbroke Island, putting them into language, so that's somebody I'm going to have to catch up with as well. Yeah, no, it's really, really beautiful, and I'm pretty sure you're going to enjoy the rest of the series because we're going to be talking about the way that culture shaped us when it comes to food, like how we learnt to hunt from different animals like in Stradbroke Island, we learnt from the sea eagle how to hunt mullet. We watched him, how he didn't hit the corner of the pack, he didn't hit, you know, the end of it or the front of it, he hit the middle. And that would actually make the mullet spit turn into a bait ball and go out of control. They lost all logic. The old eagles could all come in and just pluck them. So we do the same thing.
Watching closely.
Yeah, I think you're going to like it. We also talk about the seasons, watching the changes in the trees, how we've got a tree over there called the hop bush, H-O-P.
Yep.
And its name in Aboriginal language is Kinganyara. And Kinganyara is also the name for the oyster, and the connection there is when that tree, the hot bush we call it, when it blooms, the oyster is at its fattest, and they both have a connecting name.
Yes.
So we're going to go more into that, but I really wanted to prick people's interest and start off with these big topics, you know, these topics that you've been writing books about. I think it's inspirational. I really, really thank you for putting the effort in to taking time to educate Australia that we are missing out on a lot of wisdom and a lot of wealth that could benefit us all today, you know, as one people.
It's going to happen.
No, I thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Okay, you will talk again, I'm sure.
Oh, definitely. From little things, big things grow. This is just the start.
No jobs for us, but they all say, come and give us a brand new day. On the way to our brand new day. Everybody say, on the way to our brand new day. Everybody say. Just put rats up the older on. Still we find we don't belong. Now they want to take it all away. What can this one? Brand new day. On the way
Everybody, everybody say, on the way to a brand new day. Everybody, everybody say,
yeah, they've been talking about this gun, that gun, any gun, every gun, but still same gun, and boy, make me slide.
Thank you for joining us this week for Decolonize Your Diet, brought to you by Mother and Son Team, Tiger and Caillou Bales. Be sure to join us again next week, same time, same place. To listen to this episode again, visit our website at 989fm.com.au and hit interviews.
Decolonize Your Diet, a show that will change the way you think about hunting, gathering, and bush tucker in general.